Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to hear argument now in the case of Hoosier Energy against John Hancock Life Insurance. Mr. Willard.
May it please the Court, if the district court in this case is correct in predicting that the transaction was a tax shelter not permitted by the Internal Revenue Code, then the Internal Revenue Service will assess John Hancock with back taxes, interest, maybe even penalties. And if that's sustained, if there's further judicial review, John Hancock will pay. The critical error that the district court made was taking that one step further and saying, and in addition, this transaction will be invalid, void for illegality because of that consequence. Hundreds, thousands of corporate transactions are challenged by the IRS on an annual basis. And if every single one of those transactions were deemed void for illegality, if the IRS was predicted to prevail, that would be an astounding change in jurisprudence in this country. No case has been cited in the briefs. We could find no case where any court has ever made such a holding.
But, Mr. Willard, isn't it the case that the district court was drawing a distinction between tax shelters that have absolutely no economic substance, which the IRS does pursue? It seems to me law firms have crumbled over such things, and those transactions do fall in their entirety, and the many other hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of transactions that you're referring to where somebody's just tried to take a deduction and the IRS disallows it and you pay and life goes on.
Your Honor, the district court mentioned several times in its opinion that the transaction had no economic substance. We think that was clearly erroneous because he was relying on the affidavit of Professor Bankman. And in paragraph 36, the last paragraph of Professor Bankman's affidavit, the professor says he's not rendering an opinion on economic substance, although he reserves the right to do so in the future. His opinion was based on the fact that this was not a true lease, not that the transaction lacked economic substance. And in fact, in the AWG case, a district court case from Ohio, which he cites heavily in his affidavit, the court there reached the same finding. It found that there was economic substance in a leveraged lease transaction similar to this one, but went on to say it was not a true lease for a variety of reasons, which we think were wrong, but that's a different matter. So this is not a situation of a lack of economic substance. We also drew a distinction in our brief, and we believe the cases do as well, between what you might call an economic sham and a fact sham. An economic sham is a transaction which is legal, valid, and everything else, but is disregarded by the IRS for tax purposes, which is what they would do here. A fact sham is where someone files false documents with the IRS, makes false statements about the nature of the transaction, and they decide it never even occurred. For example, where you create a contract after the fact to try to convince the IRS there was a deal. That was not alleged here.
Actually here, it seems to me, cutting to the chase, here's this complicated transaction that has taken place, and for reasons that probably have a lot to do with the credit markets, it's unraveling. And what the district court was asked to do was make sure that the litigation could go forward in a way that would best protect any number of possible outcomes: the outcome Hancock wins, the outcome Hoosier wins, the outcome that there's rescission, whatever it may be. And so we're here to review whether, as we have now modified it, this preliminary injunction is an acceptable way to do that. Was that an abuse of discretion? So I guess I'm a little worried about getting too far into the merits of the underlying deal.
Your Honor, I would like to address that question. I will say, though, first, though, we believe that in a situation such as this, where there is virtually no chance of the plaintiffs prevailing on the merits of either of their principal theories, a preliminary injunction should not issue regardless of the other equities.
And so you would agree, then, the way you phrase that, you would agree that the question is whether there is what we sometimes describe as at least a non-negligible chance that they could win, and your position is there just isn't.
Well, that is our position, although, Your Honor, I think the legal standard ought to be higher. That is, I think they need to show more than just a slight chance that they will prevail on the merits. I think they have to show a strong case on the merits in addition to showing a favorable balance of equities, although I realize it's a multi-factor test. But in terms of the equities of the situation here as well, the preliminary injunction is not adequately protected by the bond as increased by this court, although that is certainly a step in the right direction. The purpose of a Rule 65C injunction bond is to cover the eventuality that the preliminary injunction may have been improvidently issued. In this case, $20 million is what the district court says Hoosier is probably going to have to pay if they win the case. If they lose the case, the court said they'd have to pay probably $132 million. So a $20 million bond is not adequate security for the possibility of having to pay $132 million if it turns out the preliminary injunction was improvidently issued. Our position is that that's not adequate to protect the interests of our client in this case if that happens. I would also note that the injunction here involves enjoining performance of a contract which Hoosier is not even a party. The credit default swap and the backup surety bond are contracts between AMBAC entities and John Hancock entities.
It's hard to think that Hoosier is not at least a party in interest in that contract because it has the option to replace AMBAC. Would one say that somebody holding an option with respect to a contract between A and B doesn't have a legal interest in that contract?
They may have an interest in some situations, but the contract, which, by the way, was part of the transaction which Hoosier itself engineered, provides that there are no third-party beneficiaries to the qualifying swap. So it specifically addressed that issue. That's page 55 of the qualifying swap document, has a section in saying no third-party beneficiaries. So in addition to waiving all kinds of possible defenses in the swap to payment, it also specifically rules out the possibility that Hoosier would have a litigable interest in interfering with the performance of the agreement.
Hoosier's failure within the time specified by the contract to come up with a substitute for AMBAC that triggers Hancock's right to call on AMBAC.
That's correct.
So you can't. I'm having trouble unraveling all of this to the point that Hoosier doesn't belong here.
Well, that is certainly true. That is the credit event that gives rise to the obligation to pay under the swap. But that's quite common in other arrangements, such as letters of credit, which are triggered by some underlying.
I understand that, but it's just that it seems to me you're overstating the distance of Hoosier. Suppose Hancock owns the Empire State Building and has a contract to sell it to IBM, but the contract is subject to a 60-day option held by Hoosier. Would one say, and Hoosier says we'd like to exercise the option, Hancock refuses to honor that exercise. Would one say that Hoosier had no interest in that contract when it had a 60-day option to prevent that particular sale?
Standing by itself, that could well be the case. But in this situation, we have very elaborate waivers of defenses as well as third-party beneficiary status.
I understand your position that Hoosier should lose, but I'm just having trouble, and I think Judge Wood is too, with the position that it's not even entitled to litigate.
Well, Your Honor, the whole purpose of a credit enhancement, whether it's a credit default swap, whether it's a letter of credit or a surety bond, is to provide a degree of assurance.
Certainly.
That you'll be paid.
But if one wanted Hoosier to have no role in this, you don't have Hoosier play a role in this. You would write the credit default swap so that it said, if AmBank's credit rating is reduced, then we get to draw. But it doesn't say that. It says, if AmBank's credit rating is reduced, then we get to draw if Hoosier doesn't do something in a particular time.
That's correct, Your Honor. It does do that. But it's undisputed here that Hoosier didn't do what it was supposed to do. This is not a case where Hoosier says there's been no event of default. They're saying, yes, there was an event of default. We had to replace the credit in 60 days. You gave us over 120 days.
Is that, by the way, the right way to put it? Several times the briefs say we had to replace AmBank within 60 days. Is that the right way to understand it, or is it that it had an option to replace AmBank within 60 days? Did it have a legal duty to replace AmBank, or did it have an option to replace AmBank?
They had an option. They made a business decision that it
now
would be.
Why do you say it's an option rather than a legal duty? This may be important to the case.
Your Honor, the contract said that if they failed to replace AmBank, and there were a number of things they could have done, not just a different swap provider. They could have posted a letter of credit. There were several options. But if they didn't do those things, then it would be an event of default. Hancock could declare a default, and the transaction would terminate. And if it terminated, the termination value would be paid. And they made a business decision to do that.
I'm interested in this classification between a duty and an option. I mean, suppose the contract said, if AmBank's credit rating falls, Hoosier has a duty to provide $132 million in gold doubloons, right? And, of course, we know gold clauses are legal again. And Hoosier then, and if you don't provide $130 million in gold doubloons, we can draw on this swap. And Hoosier then says, we have tried to buy up all the gold doubloons in the world, but there are only 60 million of them. Will you take cash for the other 60? And Hancock says, no, it's gold doubloons or nothing. Would one characterize that as an option to replace the document with gold doubloons or a legal duty to come up with gold doubloons? Because if they have a legal duty to do it and it's actually impossible because there aren't that many doubloons in the world and it's too late to coin them, then one might say there is an impossibility defense. But if it's just an option, it's, you know, either pay cash or pay in gold doubloons, then one might think that they can't prevent collection from AmBank. That's why I'm trying to pin this down.
I feel like I'm back in contracts class, but I think they have an option to pay. It was specifically provided. The risk was stated. It was understood. It was allocated in the contract. And it provided that if they made the business decision, which they did, not to replace the credit enhancement, that the transaction would terminate and they'd pay $121 million. Now, we don't agree that it was impossible for them to replace the credit enhancement here. Even the district court didn't go that far. He said it was nearly impossible. But as we pointed out in our reply brief, they didn't have to even get just a credit default swap provider, they could have posted a letter of credit like they did this morning for $121 million. And that would have satisfied the provisions of the contract. But their testimony was that it was prohibitively expensive to meet that provision of the contract, and they made a business decision they would rather litigate than to post that. Back to the point about Hoosier having an opportunity to litigate its interest in the way this situation is resolved, they'll have that opportunity if the injunction is dissolved.
I think the district court didn't have such a sanguine assessment of whether Hoosier could go forward with this case, because there's some discussion in the district court's opinion predicting, of course, it's the future, that if that payment has to be made, the district court was persuaded, and certainly the papers that AmBank has filed with this court seem to add support to that, too, that AmBank would immediately call on its own swap with Hoosier, Hoosier doesn't have either the $120 million or the alternative installment payment amounts, so the district court found that's all we have right now. And thus, Hoosier would be in Chapter 11, and AMBAC would be fighting through whatever the bankruptcy code has to say about swaps and everything else. So I'm not sure that this really will be litigated to completion if an immediate draw of the 120 happens.
Well, Your Honor, if AMBAC makes that kind of a demand, and if it does trigger...
Which it's already done. I mean, it said it had done so already, and the only reason it's not following through is because of the injunction.
Well, they've said they will do it. They have to pay us first before
right,
they can
right. well, but
ask to be paid back. But they have said they will do it. Hoosier does have the option to make payments on an installment plan.
Which the district court found even that would be not possible.
The court did find that. I think the evidence in support of that is quite thin, because what Hoosier has said is that they have a liquidity problem for the short term, but they can always raise their rates over time to raise money. I mean, that's the nature of an electric cooperative, is they have the ability to charge rates sufficient to cover their expenses. And
but maybe this is just all about the short term. If they can't survive the short term, then they won't be able to raise their rates either.
Well, Your Honor, filing for Chapter 11 doesn't mean they won't survive. It means they go into reorganization and can conduct business, just like
and
United Airlines.
And the credit markets have frozen up for Chapter 11s, too, according to what I read in the papers. But maybe that's loosening up now.
Well, they have not presented any evidence or argumentation that they would have to go out of business if they went into Chapter 11. And I think given the fact that they have pretty much a captive audience of electric cooperatives that are their members, that they provide with electricity, it's hard to imagine that they would have to go out of business.
What cases do you have that suggest that the Chapter 11 version of bankruptcy doesn't count as the type of irreparable injury we would take cognizance of on a preliminary injunction?
We don't have any, Your Honor. The other side doesn't have any controlling authority in this circuit saying that it does. It's a question on which we were not able to find controlling authority. But as we read the cases that talk about bankruptcy as irreparable injury, they're more couched in terms of being forced out of business, as in Chapter 7, as opposed to having to go into a reorganization and continuing in business, as many companies have done and are doing.
Well, some make it out and others don't. I mean, the move into even Chapter 11, putting to one side particular parts of the bankruptcy code that exempt transactions from the automatic stay, is a major business event at a minimum.
It is, Your Honor, although they have not presented any argument about why that would force them out of business. And I think given the nature of their business, as a electrical generating cooperative, it's highly unlikely that would happen. They have fixed assets. They have a captive audience to purchase the electricity. That's not going to change.
They're not without competitors, are they?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, and we didn't brief this issue, but it's my understanding that the rural utility service requires the member cooperatives to take their power from the generating cooperative. So I think they do have something of a captive audience.
They don't have a duty under federal law to wheel power over their lines from other generators?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, but I do know that because their customers basically own them, they're kind of in an unusual situation, because if the customers don't buy the power from them, then the customers are in effect shooting themselves in the foot.
Buy the power from wherever it's cheapest.
Yes, Your Honor, but
shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, that could be the case. But as I understand, there are also some legal technicalities that would affect that, the ability of the customers to buy power from elsewhere. Anyway, unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Willard. Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin, if I could, by just picking up on a point that Judge Wood made during Mr. Willard's presentation, that the district court really was going out of its way here to protect against the risk of error while this case is being litigated, and that we are here in the preliminary injunction posture. This Court's preliminary injunction jurisprudence is really particularly well-developed. The problem
that gives rise to, in my mind, is that Hoosier's option was time-limited. Go back to my example to Mr. Willard. Suppose Hancock owns the Empire State Building.
Right.
And it gave Hoosier a 60-day option to buy the Empire State Building. And let's suppose that option is in the money. Hoosier can make money by exercising it. And Hoosier then comes to court and says, well, we have 60 days to exercise the option, but because of the financial crunch, we have been unable to raise the money. So we want an injunction that keeps this option open indefinitely. Would it be entitled to such an injunction?
Your Honor, 2 points. First, I think you're going to the doctrine of temporary commercial impracticability. That was one of two separate and independent grounds.
I'm well aware of that.
And so I just wanted to underscore that that is but one of the district court's grounds. On that point, the district court, it seemed to me, was very cautious about underscoring the narrowness of the doctrine and was not generally asserting a free-floating judicial right.
About the district court's opinion, I've put you a hypothetical question. Where there's a time-limited option, the question is, can the district court extend the time to exercise the option? The reason I asked the question was because you were characterizing it as, well, the district court has just put this in stasis. But when you've got a time-limited option, stasis is the same thing as extending the time, and the value of an option is time-sensitive. That's why I'm asking this question.
I guess, Your Honor, I would not agree with your characterization of this as an option. I think this goes back
would
to the question you were asking.
My hypothetical question.
Yes, Your Honor. If in fact the party could show that it was not reasonably foreseeable that the contingency would occur and that it was for factors beyond its control, that is the kind of situation under which the doctrine of temporary commercial impracticability allows a court to grant a reasonable period of time.
And what do you say about cases like 407 East 61st Gage, in which the New York Court of Appeals says that difficulty of coming up with the money to satisfy an option is never a reason to extend the time of an option?
Well, again, Your Honor, without conceding that this is an option as opposed to a contractual obligation, but again, I can see Your Honor is looking at your hypothetical, at least, is an option. And
yes, I gave you an express option. We can talk later about whether this is an option or a duty, but I'm trying to figure out what happens, assuming we understand this as an option. That's why I'm asking a question about options.
Right.
But whether, as a matter of New York law, and this is a question of New York law, the highest court of New York says that inability, financial inability to exercise an option, profitable option, is a reason for extending the time to exercise the option. Now, there are several cases, I've mentioned one, that seem to me to say, that as a matter of New York law, the answer is no. It is never a reason to extend the time to exercise an option. Now, you may have other cases or other things I should be looking at, and if so, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor, there's inability and there's inability. If the inability is your ordinary inability to do something that it could be that you yourself are you're going to know that you may have times when you're unable to do something. I think what is unique here is that the entire market has frozen. In other words, this wasn't just that we ran out of money. What the district court found.
Now going in a different direction from my question.
Well, I guess, in other words,
is there, you know, I've cited 407 East 61st, which seems to me to say that inability to satisfy an option is never a reason for extending the time.
We are in our.
Is there some other New York case I should be looking at?
The Bush case, Your Honor, which was the case about the trip that was canceled because of the events of September 11th, and that was inability to get back to the travel agency within the contractually specified time to cancel the trip. And in the Cliffstar case, the court recognized that there can be some tough lines in figuring out when something is temporarily impossible.
Which case was this again?
The Bush case. It's 746 New York 2nd, 790.
Yeah, the lowest trial court. I'm interested in the decisions of the New York Court of Appeals. I mean, that's like citing a magistrate judge when I'm asking for a decision of the Supreme Court.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And even the Kelkin case that the other side cites, I don't know if that's the same one, if that's on the other side of the 460, East 47th Street or whatever, the decision that you mentioned, recognizes that this is a line drawing issue. There can be...
But that's part of the question. The decisions of the New York Court of Appeals that I've looked at suggest that it is not a question of line drawing. That a time-limited financial option expires on the last day, whether the reason for inability to meet it is no one would lend to you or somebody shot you.
Well, Your Honor,
it's just never a reason for extending a time-limited option. Now, that may or may not be a good law, but
we're
here under Erie. We're trying to play ventriloquist dummy to the New York Court of Appeals. Some of us have an easier time playing the Charlie McCarthy role than others, right? It's just a positive question. What does New York law really say?
Fair enough, Your Honor. Again, I think certainly we have not seen any. We don't read New York law as being as categorical as Your Honor just suggested. And again, if you look at Williston, I mean, these are. I don't think New York has departed from general principles of contract law that recognize these kinds of doctrines. To say that this is completely out of the question, that there can be...
No, maybe the nature of my question is still not clear to you. Every state, including New York, has a doctrine about general impossibility. If you contract for 5 crates of watermelons and there's a watermelon plague and you can't come up with the watermelons, there's a doctrine of impossibility.
Sure.
The question I'm asking is about financial contracts, which are essentially promises to pay with sometimes with options attached.
Right.
It sounds to me from the reading I have done, it seems to me from the reading I've done, that the New York Court of Appeals says for those kinds of contracts, they're not at all like coming up with watermelons or people physically unable to get from place A to place B, that they're a different stripe of contract. Now, that may be good or bad, but that's what it sounds like New York is saying.
Well, one point, Your Honor, just to point out, is that nobody here is saying that we could not pay. We've made all the rent payments in time. What we couldn't do in time was get the replacement credit enhancer within the 60-day period. So it doesn't sound like that even falls within the narrower category of cases that Your Honor is describing.
Well, I put this as a form of exercising an option. Well, let's move on to the question whether... This is understood, whether this should be understood as a duty or as an option. Because it does seem to me, if I'm correctly understanding the New York cases, the answer may turn on that. If this is a contractual duty to provide 120 million doubloons, and there just aren't 120 million doubloons, then the impossibility doctrine may apply. But if it's an option to take the contract out by supplying 120 million doubloons, then the unavailability of doubloons may be irrelevant.
Sure.
Is this a duty or an option?
It's a duty. If you look at, I refer you to pages 399 to 400 of the appendix, which is section 7.5 of the participation agreement. And at the top of page 400, it says that if the qualifying swap provider shall cease to be a qualifying swap surety bond, and then you go down a few lines, there's a lot of parentheticals, whatever. Hoosier shall within 60 days, do X, Y, and Z. So that's kind of the beginning thing. Our obligation under Section 7.5 is to find the qualifying swap provider within 60 days. Then if you look, and you have to do that if it falls below the level. Then if you look at Section 16H of the facility lease, it defines the failure to find the qualified swap provider within 60 days as an event of default. And then if you look at the credit default swaps, they define a credit event for purposes of the credit default swaps as an event of default happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this falls, in your dichotomy, Your Honor, more on the there's an obligation. You shall, and if you don't, that qualifies as an event of default, and that's what triggers this. If I could, again, just to take a step back here again, this Court's jurisprudence is really quite developed that we don't have to show at the preliminary injunction stage, the District Court doesn't have to conclude that it is more likely.
Our jurisprudence may be developed, but the Supreme Court may not think very much of our jurisprudence. Have you given a gander at Winter against NRDC?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think Winter, I thought it was very telling that the other side did not cite Winter in this Court, even though it was cited below, because Winter is all about the irreparable injury issue, and I think it is fair to say that Winter modified this Court's sliding scale to the extent that the sliding scale could have been read to suggest that anything less than a likelihood of irreparable injury can get you a preliminary injunction. I don't think Winter doesn't speak to the question of likelihood of success on the merits.
But I wanted to pick up with that because underneath all of this, I mean, we all agree that there has to be some showing, maybe a little more than before, maybe the same, but there has to be a showing of likelihood of success in the merits. And as I understand Hoosier's case, there are really two theories that you have for excusing what is obviously a failure to comply with the terms of this contract. You didn't find somebody after the credit rating went down. One of them is this impossibility and practicability theory that we're talking about. The other is what the district court called illegality. And putting to one side, you know, whether this is direct or indirect on taxes, I wanted more clarity about your theory about why this is illegal, because there are some things that when the IRS looks at them, it says, you know, shame on you, you shouldn't have taken this deduction, so now you have to pay the additional tax, you have to pay interest, and maybe you have to pay a civil penalty.
Sure.
There are other things, if you don't do them, the IRS refers you over to the criminal prosecutors.
Absolutely.
And off you go to prison.
Right.
So I was not sure which kind of thing you thought you were looking at here.
Well, Your Honor, I think the key point here is, and this distinguishes it from the opposing counsel's attempt to say, look, this is like a house. Maybe in the sale of a house, somebody was going to take an improper tax deduction that doesn't vitiate or void the entire transaction.
No, that's your economic substance argument. But how often does the IRS refer to, for criminal prosecution, people who have structured unlawful tax shelters?
Well, the IRS now has an amnesty program for this very kind of thing, the
and
silos and violos.
And when they say amnesty, are they talking about civil penalties, criminal prosecution? What do they mean?
My understanding of that program is that you pay back, you unwind the transaction and pay back 80% of the tax benefits. And, for instance, Bank of America, with whom we had another agreement that was similar to this.
So the answer is civil, not criminal.
I'm not aware of how the, you know.
Let me follow up slightly. I hope I'm not modifying my colleague's question too much. But fundamentally, Hancock has lent a bunch of millions of dollars to Hoosier against the income stream. And, of course, banks do that all the time. We don't say that that transaction is unenforceable or hollow or something like that.
We are.
Hoosier and Hancock tried to do this in a way that would transfer the depreciation shields to Hancock, which normally the bank doesn't get. So there are a lot of details of this transaction that are not ordinary loans. But it seems very hard to say that the underlying transaction in which Hancock gave Hoosier a lot of money and Hoosier promised to pay rent for the premises for a period was a transaction without substance, because Hoosier borrows money all the time.
Your Honor, I think the key point here is that the record as it stands now, and to be sure this is a very tentative preliminary record, the affidavit of Professor Bankman goes into some detail in terms of the lack of economic substance of the underlying transaction.
The lack of economic substance of the filigree, that is, the ways in which this loan transaction was modified to make it look like Hancock was an owner rather than a lender. But this credit default swap protects its position not as an owner, the thing that there may be tax problems about, but as a lender.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I'm talking here more globally about the entire transaction of which the credit default swap is a portion. In other words, the whole raison d'etre of the whole transaction is to get some for basically for Hancock to buy tax benefits. One of the conditions, these are all...
The loan look more like ownership than it really is, as
yes.
you're describing.
Yes, and...
Well,
and
but I mean, your theory is that because of this, notwithstanding Hoosier's unclean hands, that such a transaction, no matter how many contracts are patched together to make it, is, quote-unquote, illegal, but you really just mean civilly unenforceable, I think, or subject to civil penalties from the IRS.
You know, I guess I hadn't thought about the distinction between those.
Want to reclassify this, recharacterize it as a simple loan, and then say, as a consequence of that, Hancock does not get the depreciation deductions any more than a bank would. But that
right.
doesn't make the lending of money and the and what's important here, the security for the loan, because that's what the credit default swap is,
right.
it doesn't make the security for the loan illegal.
Well,
that's the problem that I'm having.
I guess, again, the record here, the Bernardi affidavit says none of this whole thing would have happened but for the tax consequences. This, you know,
maybe true, but it did happen, and loans are lawful.
Well, again, I think there are remedial questions as to when you start unwinding this, what starts to collapse. I think the district court made this is obviously a complex transaction involving 4,000 pages of contracts. This comes in an emergency basis. The district court is trying to keep the status quo at least without having Hoosier forced into bankruptcy before this is adjudicated. The district court made a draw that there's a reasonable likelihood that the entire kit and caboodle would be unlawful.
So what happens if Hoosier goes into bankruptcy? I mean, maybe we should focus on that for a second.
Well, that certainly inflicts irreparable injury on Hoosier. And you know, it is clear that the question was asked before about, you know, whether there was any case law on bankruptcy, unless it's a liquidation, is not irreparable injury. You know, the case law doesn't even say you must go into bankruptcy. It says if there's a serious threat of bankruptcy, that's enough for irreparable injury. I mean, this is basically an exception to the general rule that money is not the kind of thing that's irreparable injury. When the money becomes so great that you're talking about bankruptcy, that's where you cross the line, and you can say that the payment of money can be irreparable injury for these purposes. So I think
how close was the Berkshire agreement to completion?
The record here, Your Honor, is very clear that it was very close. The term sheet had been signed and approved.
Why hasn't it been completed?
Well, because they pulled the plug on this. Berkshire Hathaway was not about to complete its obligations when we were declared in default. That basically made the whole thing go poof. They wouldn't provide.
I'm totally lost. Berkshire Hathaway doesn't care whether you were in default on this. Berkshire Hathaway cares about whether it can make money on its substitute agreement by serving as the new intermediary.
Right, but if Berkshire Hathaway is putting itself in a position where Berkshire, as the credit enhancer.
Maybe they're different. Do you have a commitment letter from Berkshire Hathaway saying, we will serve as the intermediary, provided the district court declares that there is no existing default? Anything like that?
No, Your Honor.
But do you have a letter from them saying, because Hancock declared a default on October the 23rd, we are no longer interested in dealing with you, or a deposition or a phone call or something?
Well, again, the record is, I mean, the Bernardi affidavit walks through this, and they had said within 90 days we can do this.
Yeah, that's not the question.
Well, I understand that. They pulled the plug and said we were in default, and the upshot of that was that Berkshire Hathaway would not provide the credit enhancement.
I just don't understand. This is a commercial transaction. Berkshire Hathaway has the money. It can stand as the intermediary if it wants. Presumably, it would be entitled to say to Hancock, we will substitute in as the financial intermediary here only if you give us a letter saying that there's no default and we're not immediately going to be called on to pay. And Hancock will at that point either accept Berkshire Hathaway or not. But apparently we've never gotten to that point.
Well, because Hancock said you were in default. In other words, but Berkshire Hathaway wouldn't.
No, you're not listening. has Berkshire Hathaway ever gone to Hancock and said, if we give you a credit default swap or a letter of credit as an intermediary, will you rescind your declaration of default and say, this is a good document, we're happy? Has anybody ever gone to Hancock and said, here it is, here's the money, rescind your letter, here's the money? Anybody ever done that?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, because what happened was that they sent us a letter of default.
If you look, of course they sent you a letter of default. And what I've just said is, of course, what happens in a commercial transaction.
Well, I think what you're, as I hear you, Your Honor, and maybe I'm mishearing you, you're saying, well, gee, couldn't you have cured this by having Berkshire Hathaway then go to say, look, this is all much ado about nothing. We can solve this still.
Because the alternative understanding is that this is all just hot air. That Berkshire Hathaway has never made a commitment. Its term sheet had all sorts of limitations about X and Y and Z being satisfactory to us, and Berkshire has never declared that they were all satisfactory to it. So from Hancock's perspective, this litigation is just about dragging out the 60 days to 120 days, 180 days, 365 days, and depriving them of the benefit of the security they thought they had negotiated.
Your Honor, one point there. In the district court, they could come back and offer a limited period of time. I mean, in a sense, this is really a perverse situation we're in, where basically if there were to be a situation where we could get the additional time, we could negotiate with Berkshire Hathaway to try and do that. Presumably the district court is going to keep monitoring the preliminary injunction.
It can't be keep monitoring. Well, I can imagine a district court setting a deadline saying, if you don't have a letter of the kind I've described by date X, Hancock can draw. I can't imagine what seems to be your position, which is, we will keep this in stasis forever, always talking but never performing.
Your Honor, no, Your Honor, because again, a PI under Rule 65 is always subject to modification. I don't see the district court.
The injunction needs a terminal date. That's the point I'm saying. Whether it's preliminary or not, it can't string this out forever.
And that's fair enough, Your Honor. And again, I think the district court certainly talked about temporary commercial impracticability. It was not talking about stringing this out forever. And if this is an issue of the district court,
I don't want to pursue this at length, but the very fact that Berkshire Hathaway was, you say, willing to step in undermines the claim of commercial impracticability. It says that maybe we needed an injunction to go from 60 days to 90. But you've already had that and more, and yet there isn't a commitment letter from Berkshire Hathaway.
But that's because once the letter of default came, Berkshire Hathaway was no longer interested in this. And
this doesn't make any sense.
But
all right. Thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Linden. Mr. Hoff, anything other than that you don't want to be in the middle?
Thank you, Your Honor. We are in the middle. We just don't want to be...
To be whipsawed by having no defenses on one side and defenses on the other side.
Exactly, and we want to make sure that the transaction is accurately described. It's a credit default swap. It's not a... Not
you don't want the Seventh Circuit issuing an opinion saying AMBAC is on its last legs, in other words.
That we don't
want.
That
would do
we don't want
favors.
That either. Yes, yes.
How frequently do those ratings change?
There's no schedule. When the rating agencies have a reason to rate,
right.
And there are various ratings that they do on various entities.
However, in the last year, there's very little correlation between the ratings and reality.
I'm not going to touch that one. Your Honor, yes, you're right. We did not weigh in on whether the injunction should be granted or not granted. We are prepared, AMBAC is prepared to comply with its contractual obligation. We don't want to be in a position where we have to pay and then we cannot.
But you've made it quite clear that you're going to look to Hoosier. If the time comes that you have to pay Hancock, you are immediately going to turn around and look to Hoosier for its payment,
right. Well, however
structured, in a lump sum or under installments.
AMBAC exercised that alternative settlement procedure under the lessee swap.
Under the lessee swap, right.
Yes.
There's
and
no
we,
doubt that AMBAC would take that step if the first step were to happen.
Yes, and we expect that that we would be able to do that without without any inner assertion of defenses based upon Hancock's conduct.
Yeah, waiver defenses works on one side. It's got to work on the other.
Yes, yes. If you're going to enjoin the entire transaction, so be it. But if you're going to reverse the injunction, has to be.
And in the meantime, Anbach's just making these payments, and Hancock's crediting them against its loan, and life is going on. Is that?
Well, whatever payments Anbach has to make under whatever operative documents there are, and is, that Anbach is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Willard? I'm betting that there is.
May it please the Court, I just wanted to...
I will not issue an enforceable default swap in support of that belief.
Yes, Your Honor, I just wanted to comment on a couple of issues that came up, questions raised by the Court during Mr. Landau's argument. First, to turn to the tax issue here. The plaintiffs have never alleged that this was a fraudulent transaction. And, of course, it's understandable because they promoted the transaction, and promoting a tax fraud is itself a crime. So they've not alleged that this is anywhere close to criminal. The district court, I think, got carried away, and three times in his opinion he referred to it as fraudulent. We think that was just a slip of the pen. If he did find it was fraudulent, that was clearly erroneous because there's no evidence here of fraud.
So your understanding of the district court's references to illegality are simply the kind of civil illegality that happens sometimes in Texas?
That's correct, Your Honor. And neither the district court nor the plaintiffs here have ever been able to suggest why this transaction, if it's disallowed, is any worse than any other kinds of transactions that are disallowed for tax purposes and create liability. You might have to pay interest, you might have to pay a civil penalty, but the idea that this is somehow different from many transactions that get challenged successfully by the IRS is something they've never been able to justify other than by using a lot of language. It reminds me of what Baron Rolfe said about gross negligence. It's negligence with the addition of a vituperative epithet.
You've got to get something for your legal education.
Then getting back to temporary commercial impracticability, the district court suggested that Hancock should have given an additional 90 days to allow the Berkshire Hathaway transaction to go through. If it had done so, those 90 days would be up 2 weeks from tomorrow. And I think as the court brought out from Mr. Landau, the Berkshire Hathaway transaction is not being pursued at this time.
But I understand that to be because as soon as Hancock declared the default, maybe it was just a failure of imagination, I don't know, mm-hmm. but nobody continued to go back to Berkshire Hathaway and say, well, now Hancock has declared default, but if you come back with a letter indicating you'll serve, we're hopeful that they'll rescind that or whatever. I mean, none of that happened. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway walked away. They walked away. Everything took this course.
As far as we know from the record, that's true, Your Honor.
Is Hancock willing to send the kind of letter that I suggested? Send a letter to Berkshire Hathaway saying, if you step in place of Anbach, we will be happy. All declarations of default are hereby formally ripped up.
No, Your Honor. Hancock is certainly willing to discuss settlement options with the plaintiff, as we have in the past, under the district court sponsorship, but we'd rather not do that in open court.
All right.
With regard to the temporary commercial impracticability point, I would just like to emphasize, though, that this is not a case where there are not 120 million gold doubloons in the world. This is a case where credit has become tight, but it's not impossible. Most of the credit enhancers were downgraded below the acceptable level, but not all. And even the district court, although it sometimes got carried away, the judge said, well, nearly impossible, yeah. Not impossible.
No, I certainly understand your position that you contracted for security in the event of financial hard times, and the district court has said, aha, there are financial hard times, therefore your security vanishes.
Yes, Your Honor. You have the security when you don't need it. But if you do, it's not there.
But the other thing you contracted for was the dollar equivalent of the tax benefits that you were hoping to get. And if it is indeed an in the milder sense I'm using the term, an unlawful tax transaction. It does seem that all those companies like Bank of America that went to the IRS for the amnesty were chumps. You know, they should have just gotten the same tax benefit your way.
Well, Your Honor,
something evasive about that.
Well, Your Honor, most of the money of the termination payment is a return of equity to Hancock, the money they invested. But there is also return of expected, you know, of earnings on that equity, and that does include a tax-advantaged component. So it certainly is part of the – it's not the most of it, but it's part of it. And, of course, the IRS might still – might disallow these tax benefits, and Hancock may have to pay a big bill to the government at some point in the future as well. So, I mean, it's not as though Hancock is completely out of the woods here. I see my time has expired.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.